This is Regionally Speaking from Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we occasionally have an opportunity to find out what's happening in the city of Valparaiso by talking to the man at the top of the food chain, so to speak. Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy is with us. And Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Hey, good morning, Chris. How are you?
Well, it's been a while since we've last talked, and the city council has come up with a number of projects and ordinances and resolutions that they have worked on. And there are some in particular, I think, that have caught many people's, certainly their eyes and maybe their attention. And let's go through a few of them here. If you will first talk about, I guess, what could be commonly called a golf cart ordinance. Will you tell us how that got started and where it stands right now?
Sure. It's come up over the years. Residents have asked about giving them the option for an additional transportation in a safe way. The ordinance allows registered golf carts to travel on designated, and that's the key, designated city streets, primarily residential roadways. So we've carefully researched this, and the ordinance puts in place safety guidelines. I'll give you an idea, such as golf carts are not allowed on major streets. Golf carts must be inspected and registered. The drivers of the carts must be licensed. And seat belts must be worn, among other things. The Valparaiso Police Department will begin registering golf carts next week. And if residents are interested in registering their carts, they can call the Valparaiso Police Department and make an appointment.
Is this a concept that has come about, I'm sure, in some cities and certainly in the South in warmer climates, where you've got gated communities that have country clubs and golf courses that are included in there? And I'm sure that residents who live in those areas probably, if they're going to go play a few rounds, hit 18 holes or maybe only 9 if they don't have the time, that they're going to want to take, if they live in a neighborhood like that, and they want to take the golf cart to get over to the club. Is that something that somebody in Valparaiso thought about?
Well, I think a lot of the communities in just in Porter County already have golf carts, and some even like the town of Chesterton have gone to the degree of allowing them on their city streets as well.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that Porter County is also considering it. They've got a lot of rural subdivisions that they're interested. So we just kind of see it as a trend, and we feel that with the right regulations and safeguards, it can be done in a safe way.
One of the other ordinances that has come up and has finally gotten approved by the Valparaiso City Council is one that is a little more serious than riding golf carts on certain streets. It's dealing with problems, and certainly police have this often, and they want to get it resolved. And it turned out to end up becoming what is called a disorderly property ordinance. Will you give us an idea what the police chief has come to you and talked about over time that led to the creation of this ordinance that's now in effect?
Yeah, it's actually called, we call it a public nuisance ordinance. And like you said, it was initiated by our police department as a result of some properties in the city requiring an unacceptably high number of police calls. We initially met with the property owners that were requiring excessive police service. And when that wasn't successful, we looked to what other communities have done for best practices. We found communities like South Bend, St. Joe County, and Fort Wayne, where they saw success in improving public safety through their public nuisance ordinances, which essentially share responsibility for public safety with the property owner, imposing fines for excessive calls to the police department. We passed the ordinance at the end of July, and it's working. Some of the property owners affected have reached out to the police department and are now working together with our PD. The property owners are being more proactive in reducing crime and encouraging more of a police presence nearby. The reduced need for police calls and increased police presence are sending a positive message, reinforcing that Valparaiso is a safe place.
Mm-hmm. I would assume that probably one of the focuses of the ordinance is certainly not to discourage people to call the police when they're really needed, but there are many, many occasions, and landlords, I'm sure, are the ones that can best deal with these problems without having to bring the police into it.
Absolutely right. We're not discouraging folks that need help to call it anyway. It's these repeat offenders where they treat the Valparaiso Police Department like their own private security force, and they're not dealing with the issues. And it's essentially pulling our resources off of the streets in Valpo to deal with these unfortunate situations that they just need to get on top of it. And so, like I said, we've already seen an improvement, and I'm confident that this ordinance will really help address that issue.
Mm-hmm. Were there any neighborhoods in particular that seemed to be problem neighborhoods with a lot of these properties that seemed to come up with lots of rather frequent police calls?
No, they were pretty well spread throughout the city. we won't go into naming properties, but it wasn't just one for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, this is we've already seen improvement. We're really optimistic that this is going to be a good tool for us.
That's good to hear. One interesting matter that you've taken up here created what's called a youth council. It's now in effect, and it's going to get a lot of young people in Valparaiso more civically involved, I'm sure. Will you tell us more about the youth council, how it got started, and how it's working so far?
Yeah, you know, the idea really emanated from my relationship with my predecessor, Mayor Costas, and mm-hmm. his goal, one of his major goals was to have the most civically engaged city of our size in Indiana and the Midwest. And so we began different programs. We can engage our citizens. Citizens Government Academy is very popular. We do that every year. We have a police academy, a Citizens Police Academy. That's also very popular. And then one area that we thought we could try to find some improvement in getting younger people involved was how can we get our school age, our high school kids, give them a little taste of what city government's like. So we had 18 VHS juniors sworn in participate this year, selected through an application process. The goal of the Youth Council is to promote leadership skills, community engagement, and knowledge of city government. And we want to learn from the students as well. We hosted a youth council retreat on Saturday. It's a great way for our young council members to get to know more about each other. Working in the city. One of the highlights of the retreat was a fun speed dating activity with some of our departments. The students got to spend about 10 minutes with each of the different departments, learning more about what they do, services they provide, and really what kind of career path opportunities exist. It was exciting to see future leaders asking questions, interacting with us in a more personal way. At the end of the day, we asked what their biggest aha moment was during the retreat.
Uh-huh.
And really, most were surprised by how much our departments work together and interact to get things done in Valparaiso. It's really a cool program. We're excited for our inaugural class.
That's very good to hear. Are many of these young people perhaps ones who have taken civics classes in high school, or they've been involved in various programs, maybe they've been in scouting or something related like that, where they get a little taste of volunteer work or community involvement before they got involved with the Youth Council?
Yeah, you know, I'd say some yes and some no. And we really relied on the school. Valparaiso Community Schools was a great partner in helping us communicate to the juniors, incoming juniors, what this program was all about, and they helped they're part of the reason we had more applicants than spots, which is mm-hmm. a good problem. We had just a great outpouring of interest, excellent kids, and so the school has really helped identify and promote the program.
Now, how long are the youth council members on the council? Is there a term limit, so to speak, or are they serving for like a year or two or something?
They'll have 10 more meetings, 10 more monthly meetings, in addition to the retreat we just had. So it's a 10-month term and with one meeting a month, and the big meeting was Saturday.
Well, that's great. There are a lot of people who are very interested, and they're waiting for the vacancies to pop up on the Youth Council, and they'll take over and keep things going. It sounds very good, to be sure. Mayor,
yeah, we've already received some interest from 10th graders looking at it next year, so it's really exciting.
That's great to hear. Mayor Murphy, we talked before, and we'll bring up again about how the street projects and the like are coming along, and since we've had some great weather, of course, maybe too great, got pretty hot for the longest time, but that didn't seem to bother the contractors. They could keep their projects going. What's the latest on street work that's underway in the city of Valparaiso?
Well, we have another busy paving year we're kicking off. We're looking forward to a $2.6 million roadway renovation in the city of Valparaiso that kicks off next week. The projects will rehab some of our most traveled roadways, including Calumet from Morgan to Bullseye Lake, Roosevelt from LaPorte to Calumet, and Morgan from Lincoln Way to Calumet. This project was funded with support from a $1 million community crossing grant. Projects will include structural resurfacing, which will substantially extend the life of the roadway, plus pavement markings, some curb repairs, sidewalk repairs, and ADA ramps. Projects will begin all out after Popcorn Fest on September 11th and is planned to be substantially complete by Thanksgiving. We're taking great pains with this paving project to minimize disruption of motorists and businesses, with much of the work happening in the overnight hours.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to this substantial paving project, we'll be making investments in other areas that matter to our residents. More upgrades than ever this year to sidewalks and alleys, especially in our older neighborhoods. And we're also looking at trip hazards and making the city sidewalks smoother and more accessible. So neighborhood streets are also on our radar, and we're looking to add a number of streets to our project list in the coming weeks.
That's great to hear. I know that part of our chance to talk brings up topics involving economic development. I know there are a number of projects that are underway and some improvement projects that are out there. Will you bring us an update on how some of them are doing? I know one in particular has gotten a lot of attention, is a conversion of what used to be some residential space over at Valparaiso, near Valparaiso mm-hmm. University, and turning it into something that the city is going to be able to take advantage of. Where does projects like that stand right now?
Yeah, the Uptown conversion, they have two buildings that are converting from student housing to workforce housing, and that was recently approved by the city council, and dealing with some parking challenges over there, but that's going to happen here probably next year. So that's a positive project over on Lincoln Way. We want to mm-hmm. keep that area strong and vibrant, so look for that to happen in short order. We've got a couple of great housing projects going on in the downtown. The Calkins Hill project, near Morgan, on the east side of the downtown, where the White House was. That's a great project. We some nice townhomes invested down there, and we're looking to do more residential housing in our downtown. That's one of our major goals, is to increasing the housing density in our downtown, a stronger retail environment, and we've also at the same time going to have to deal with some parking challenges that all brings with that density.
Right. Are there any other projects coming up? I know that you don't want to give anything away, especially if it's a project that the city is working with a contractor or a business and still working out the details, but can we expect any big projects coming up in the months ahead, certainly, for the city of Valparaiso?
Yeah, we've got some big plans in the horizon. You know, we were still, obviously, we're focused on finishing what we started with the Journeyman Distillery project. That's still ongoing. That's a major, massive project. $30 million of private investment, $15 million of public investment. And so that's one we're eager to get going. And that's just, again, it's such a massive project. It's taken a lot of planning city talent and private sector talent to get that going, but we're soon going to see that project get off the ground. So that's exciting, and we also have some more projects downtown that I think we're doing another planning session. Really, the blueprint for our downtown that we used for many years was called the Hyatt Palma Study, and that was really the catalyst or the blueprint, the plan for why our downtown is so vibrant. And we're updating that again. We've updated it a number of times. This time we're using a firm called Context, and they're studying the downtown with our stakeholders, and we're making sure that we're constantly keeping an eye on our downtown, which is the heart and soul of our community. And we can't take our eye off it, and we want to keep breathing life into it and make sure that it stays vibrant.
It's Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy with our occasional comments about how the city of Valparaiso is doing, the projects underway and the like. And Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
There's been a report put together by the Indiana Commission for Higher Education and Foster Success in looking into public colleges and universities to find out how campuses are helping support students who may face housing and food insecurity. That report has come out recently. And to tell us more about it, we have the president and CEO of Foster Success, Dr. Maggie Stevens, with us. And Dr. Stevens, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thanks for making time to have this conversation, Chris.
Will you give us an idea of how the idea of approaching colleges and universities that are publicly supported here in Indiana came about to find out more about the campuses and what kind of activities they have to help their students?
Absolutely. So Foster Success, as you know, we support teens and young adults across the state of Indiana who are transitioning out of foster care, aging out of foster care. And we know that specifically when we talk about these young adults that we work with at Foster Success, we find significant rates of housing and food insecurity. So, for example, nationally, 25% of individuals who age out of foster care experience homelessness within 2 years of leaving the foster care system. Here in Indiana, we surveyed our young people that we work with across the state, and over the past year, 20% of those individuals reported that they had some experiences with housing instability over the past year. But we also knew that this challenge isn't unique to just the students that we're working with as they age out of foster care, that housing and food insecurity and really meeting some of the basic needs that allow college students to focus on their education is pervasive. And so we had an opportunity over the past year to partner with the Commission for Higher Education with some support from the United Way of Central Indiana and really dig into this conversation and identifying what resources are available for these students to minimize the impact of housing and food and other basic needs on campuses and in their college experience.
How many publicly supported colleges and universities here in Indiana did you all reach out to, and how many responded to the survey?
So we reached out to all of the public institutions, every regional campus, four-year, two-year residential commuter. And for the purposes of the data analysis, we heard back from 27 campuses, and so a good percentage or the majority of the campuses. Wonderfully enough, once we sent the draft report out to get some feedback, the campuses whose data might not be included in the front part of the report that really does the data analysis did provide information for us for the appendices. And one of the great pieces of this report are the profiles at the back of it that highlight what resources are available on each of our public institutions across the state to support students in their time of need and meeting these basic needs. Mm-hmm.
Did you find in responding to the report that you had better luck getting information from the larger publicly supported colleges and universities like IU and Purdue, and maybe it didn't get quite as much information back from the smaller places like, just for example, Bethel College or Hanover College, the ones that are smaller campuses to begin with?
So we, for the purposes of this report and this go around with the data collection, we focus specifically on our public colleges and universities.
Right.
So that wouldn't include schools like Bethel and Hanover because they're independent private colleges.
I see.
And so they weren't included in this. As far as size for our public institutions, you know, I think it was really across the board. So again, we heard from some of our, you know, big residential 4 years, and we heard from some of the smaller regional Ivy Tech campuses as well.
Now, in your responses that you received from the campuses, what were some of the things that you had learned about as far as whether students that were having problems either in finding housing or getting enough to eat so they could properly act in school to be able to learn properly? What did you learn?
So we found 76% of the campuses who responded, so, you know, an overwhelming majority, do have some type of food pantry on campus to meet needs. And many of them have minimal to no restrictions regarding how frequently a student can come, access resources, get food, get some basic needs. You know, so that's wonderful in meeting that. But on the other side, when we look at our residential campuses, we had 9 residential campuses respond to us. And while 2/3 of them provide housing for students in the summer, in between, you know, the traditional academic year and different situations, only 1/3 of those campuses provide winter break housing for all students. So that time when the first semester ends in the middle of December to the middle of January over the winter holidays, a lot of students are, you know, looking for places to go and don't have that security or that option to stay on campus. And so I think that's a big gap that we want to work to close for students so that they can have stable housing even through the winter time.
Did you find in going over the data and getting the responses back that there were some campuses that were maybe better equipped for dealing with the problems that students have, especially in between semesters, but in particular in trying to find a food kitchen or some kind of place that will provide extra food if they need it?
Yeah, you know, like I said, about, you know, 3/4 of the campuses do have some type of on-campus food resource. You know, IU Bloomington talks a lot about their campus kitchen and what they're able to provide for students to really meet the needs of students, especially during breaks when there's not as many resources on campus. You know, so that would be one example, I would say. As you look up in your community, you know, Purdue Northwest was one of 4 campuses that identified the fact that they keep housing available for students who report that they're experiencing homelessness to help them meet that most immediate need and get them connected to some longer-term solutions.
I know that you discovered and put together in the report some very interesting information about housing insecurity. You mentioned here, first off, about Purdue University Northwest having a campus housing open for students that need the help. Are there any other areas that you found that need to be improved upon that you hope that the Commission for Higher Education will help?
You know, so absolutely. I mean, I think there are a handful of campuses that are doing this work and providing the space, and they're all doing, some, you know, a little bit of something. What we really identified through this study is a need for, you know, probably some more robust data from our students to better understand the actual need. What this report does and does well is identify what resources campuses are providing and how, you know, and campuses reported to us that they track use of resources, but that doesn't get to the underlying issue of what the real need is there. And so that's a piece that we're hoping that, you know, through Foster Success, through the Commission for Higher Education and other organizations, we can dig a little bit more deeply into with the campuses to understand need. And then I think the second piece of that is across the board, you know, we all just want to continue to increase awareness for students that these support programs, support resources are there. And whether that's, you know, increased communication, you know, one campus talked about faculty members including information on course syllabi about how to access support if you're in need of basic needs, including food, housing, transportation, et cetera. And so our goal is really hoping to get this information out there and possibly, you know, create a little bit of positive peer pressure and inspire campuses to try to do some new things based on what they read their peers are doing across the state.
Now, Dr. Stevens, is there anything that's come out of this report and the study that came together to be able to put the report out that you would like to see Foster Success and the Indiana Commission for Higher Education get together on in the future?
I think we'll continue to grow, you know, what we've done in this first round of data collection. I have no doubt that there'll be a need to continue to collect this information. And then related to that, you know, Foster Success is simultaneously collecting additional information about specific programs and supports for students who are aging out of foster care. And so we hope that in the next few months we'll have some additional data and reporting to share about those programs and supports for our young adults who are aging out of foster care as well. And then, you know, coupled with that, we just want to continue to increase awareness both across campuses so that they all can continue to do more and amongst our college students so they know what is available to them as they move through their college experience.
That's wonderful. Dr. Maggie Stevens is the president and CEO of Foster Success, and Foster Success has been partnering with the Indiana Commission for Higher Education in looking into what Indiana public colleges and universities are doing and helping support students that may have housing and food insecurity. And Dr. Stevens, thank you for the information and hope to hear back from you again soon.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you, Chris.
After a week of rumors and speculation, Camp Atterbury near Edinburgh was tapped as a location to house Afghan refugees. And Mitch Leegan tells us they could start arriving as early as this week.
U.S. Representative Greg Pence announced on Twitter this morning that the Defense Department has approved Camp Atterbury to temporarily house refugees fleeing the Taliban. He said he expected the camp to be ready to accept refugees in the next couple days and that it should be able to hold 5,000 people. When asked about the decision, Governor Eric Holcomb said he didn't know how many refugees would end up living in Indiana, but he would be making an announcement on the situation soon.
Too soon for the estimates, but this is a temporary home, part of the process that will unfold over the upcoming weeks.
Refugees who arrive at Camp Atterbury will undergo health and safety screenings before being permanently settled across the United States. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Mitch Leegan.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you tomorrow.